Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
Nice. Were you taking your time, like the film we watched? Drawing it out for suspense.
Maybe.
And Cole's sitting on the couch as well. I don't know, we may or may not hear from her this week.
Maybe. I embarrassed myself last time.
No, you don't know that for sure.
I
loved your heated debates about Paul Thomas Anderson. I thought that was fantastic. But on to the film at hand. We just finished watching George Sluzier's film from 1988, The Vanishing. And I really hope I'm pronouncing that surname correctly. Sluzier.
No one's going to correct you, so
it's fine.
You're okay.
Yes. A film neither of us had seen it before. I had seen the US remake back in, like, maybe 1995 or something. So, like, you know, 20-something years ago.
Starring Sandra Bullock.
Jeff Bridges,
which is
Kiefer nice. Sutherland, and everyone's favorite 90s girl, Nancy Travis.
Who's that?
She's the lady in So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Oh, yeah. She's good.
She's great. but yeah, so I was really looking forward to seeing the original, and having heard a lot about it throughout the years, and, you know, it's a very highly regarded thriller, so glad we saw it.
Well, it's a long film, coming in at roughly 100, and...
It's just shy of 2 hours.
110 minutes, but,
Do you want to do a plot synopsis?
Well, it simply follows a self-proclaimed sociopath that decides to test whether he is truly evil or good or bad, whatever, by seeing that if he can pull off a kidnapping of a female, and in doing so, if he can pull it off, he knows that he is evil. And the film follows his preparation, but also follows his the girlfriend's husband
or friend or however
friend.
At
some points he mentions she's a friend.
Rex,
at
we'll just points, call him Rex.
At some point Rex mentions that she's a wife. Anyway, it follows the two stories, that is the kidnapper and the kidnappee's husband's slash friend.
Yes. And his kind of torment and what he's going through 3 years later after her disappearance and starting to get kind of taunted a little bit by...
Yeah. But the interesting thing about this film is it does it in a very non-linear way.
Yes.
And that is probably the kind of jewel in the crown of the film.
Yeah, it's the hallmark of what made this, I think, like a standout thriller and why I now understand why it is so... well-regarded and kind of considered one of these classic modern thrillers is, yeah, the nuts narrative structure and the way it's presented.
Because it's a simple story, really.
It really is.
If you break it down, if we were to break it down in a linear fashion, it's simply a kidnapper deciding to kidnap a female, preparing for, you know, the details of the kidnapping. The kidnapping occurs... And then there is a follow-through of the repercussions 3 years after.
I would almost say if you were to do this in a more traditional fashion, I reckon you would have the normal setup of the film, how we normally get, like with the kidnapping happening. Then I think it would jump to 3 years later and we would follow Rex as our protagonist. And it's only after he finally meets Raymond, the kidnapper, and, you know, agrees to find out what happened to Saskia, his friend slash wife or whatever. That's at the point, I think, if we were going to go like, a stereotypical modern narrative, then we would get the flashback to see the methodology of how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, the linear process, because it'd be then kind of, the assumption would be he's explaining to Rex what had happened versus just being a flashback, I guess.
Yeah.
But instead, what George Sluzier, the director, decides to do is put that all right up the front. even to the point of, like, before the kidnapping happens, before you even know there's going to be a kidnapping, you get a really suspect scene of a weird, creepy guy putting on a fake broken arm cast and, like, doing something, and you know bad shit's going to happen. Like, they put it all right on Front Street. It's really interesting.
Yeah, but it does skip over the actual abduction, and you don't really get to see anything about that for ages. But yeah. I love that. I mean,
that's the tease. That's what keeps you watching. You want to know. That's what makes this a mystery and a thriller. You want to know what happened to Saskia. You know how he did it, but you actually, it's that thing of, like, when people are driving down the highway and there's a car accident, everyone fucking slows down to look at the car accident because they want to see what happened. That's what this film is. Like, you want to see, you know something bad happened, but you want to see what happened.
Mm. Yeah, the film kind of reminded me of Memento, actually, in that it gives you the whole, it keeps coming back to the abduction sequence.
Yeah.
It doesn't give you all of the pieces. It gives you these kind of memorable little moments, stuff like the Coke can that's being crushed by something.
Yeah.
And then you'll later see that event occur when the kidnapper drives over the Coke can and crushes it. And those kinds of things are occurring throughout the film. You keep returning, and it's like this odd feeling of comfort because you know the place. But then at the same time, it's very eerie and kind of just freaky somewhat.
Yeah.
Even though it's in the daytime. And
there's like hundreds of people around. That's what makes it like kind of weird and frightening.
It makes it fucking frightening, man. Because
it does, yeah.
I would like to think that I would never get kidnapped in the daytime. But then the guy makes it look so fucking easy.
Yeah. Should we talk about that? How there's a giant chunk that is, like, really the first act of the film is the methodology and his and Raymond's preparation for the kidnapping is a really base how-to guide.
I know, it's almost like a video, like a VHS you could buy in the early 90s that's just, you buy it and it has a disclaimer that you shouldn't kidnap.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to, here's how.
This is how you do it. Yeah, pretty much. It's
very detailed, man.
It's detailed enough, but, like, it's still, yeah. But I think that's interesting and kind of adds to the whole kind of scariness of the situation is seeing how easy it is to do this.
Raymond is very thorough.
He is.
The best part about the how-to video, because he is...
You know he's fucking determined as well.
He's scientific.
Yeah, I mean, well, he's a math professor, so that's...
Is it ether that he's using?
I assumed chloroform.
Some kind of chloroform thing. He's getting that out, and he's testing himself on how long it's going to knock somebody out. He's testing multiple times how to get a woman into the car and what kind of moves he's going to need to put her under the influence of her
chloroform. Plus also the driving distance and availability, like, you know, the time frame he has to be able to put her in a box and bury said box, as we find out.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's... This might make me sound like a sociopath, but I found that all really interesting. To me, that was the highlight of the film. Because it's something you don't normally see in a thriller. I would happily argue that Raymond is the protagonist of this film. He is the person we see the most of, and it's his story we're getting. Like, if this was Rex's story, we would have stuck with him for a period of those 3 years, as opposed to just picking up now, 3 years later, he's starting the search again, based on a dream he had. But it really is Raymond's story and him coming to terms with, can he do this? What has he done? And it's super fucking fascinating.
Yeah, if you liken it to, say, another film that's in the collection, Silence of the Lambs.
Yep.
You never really get to see Buffalo Bill's process.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And but you're interested in Buffalo Bill. You know, because everyone seems to be fascinated by criminals, cases of criminality.
Oh, look at, like, what's happening in podcasts and TV at the moment, like, Serial being a huge podcast, like, Making of a Murderer, and The Night of, and fucking People vs. O.J. Simpson, like, that's, murder is blowing up on TV and in media at the moment, it's crazy.
But you rarely get to see such a detailed process of a criminal.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, this film, I would admit, is drawn out a little bit, and I got a little bit bored here and there.
Yeah,
but
I agree with that.
It's always jumping back. I suppose the fact that it's jumping around so much means that you're going to... all of a sudden, you're going to be just jumping into a really interesting little sequence.
Yeah.
And you never know when that's going to occur. But it is those sequences where there's that detailed, thorough look into the process of a sociopath or psychopath or whatever, that just kind of pulls you in and you fucking want to learn more about it.
And it's also the brilliant storytelling where you don't understand why he's doing this. It's just presenting it to you. Like you said earlier, like he's very scientific about his methods. And the filmmakers are really clever in just presenting it as such. Like we've been saying, like a how-to video. It's just a step-by-step process of this guy planning. We don't find out his motivations or anything like that until the third act, which it, again, falls into that thing of, like, wanting to keep you fucking knowing and wondering, what is this all for? What is the end game here?
But even then, his motivations are kind of ethereal.
Yeah, which is, again, I'll let you continue there.
Because you know that he is a family man, he's got a family, and he seems to be attached to his family, and he seems to even love his family. And so on a surface level, you're going, well, this person seems legit, seems like he has some empathy, so he's not actually a sociopath, and yet he is preparing for these crazy acts, and, you know, by the end, he fucking fulfills those crazy acts.
Yeah.
And yet, even with his motivation, which is, as far as I can tell, if I'm a hero or a good person, let's test that and see if I can be a bad person, whether I can fulfill that. What can I do that's bad? I can kidnap a woman.
Yeah, and it also ties into the just base dichotomies of human existence. Like he tells the story of being a kid up on the balcony. You don't jump, so I jumped. It's doing the opposite of what you are supposed to do. So he had that moment where he was a hero, so he needs to see if the pendulum swings back the other way. It makes for such an interesting character. And when you find out that that is his motivation, that it is based on a pure analytical, scientific thing of, like, I want to research and find out about this of my own psyche. It's not for pleasure, it's not for any, you know, immoral gratification or whatever, you know, you get from it. It's a purely analytical reason of why he's doing this, and it's...
Yeah, it's very bleak.
Very original. Like, I don't think I've seen another film that tackles this subject matter like that.
It's... Because of that, I think that it's hard to... It's hard to actually approach him as a character.
Yeah.
Which fits, because if you're a sociopath, you're not... People are not really meant to understand you if they happen to be a caring individual.
Yeah.
So it kind of works, but at the same time, you want to get even further into the head. So I did come away from the film wanting to know more about him.
Yeah.
And I feel like the film didn't deliver to the fullest extent. Unless it's simply about let's have an exploration of the extremes of heroism versus, you know, just complete... It's not even corruption. He's just so distant that he doesn't care about being a hero either.
Not at all. And that's the thing he says. Like, his daughter worshipped him in the moment that he was a hero, saving that little girl from drowning. Yet he felt nothing from that. And
I think it seemed like he actually... There was a shot on that sequence where he's the hero that saves the kid in the river. Mm. That sequence finishes on a shot of a close-up of his face.
Yeah.
And it seemed to highlight to me that he had a little bit of pleasure in the idea that he didn't rescue the doll of the kid, and the kid was upset.
Which is... Well, that's where I think he got... that planted the seed
okay.
of the idea. That's what I think that
ah, was yes. doing. Okay, interesting.
That's what I, yeah. The idea that he can both do one act, which is both viewed by his family and obviously the parents of the little girl that he saved as something incredibly heroic, yet the little girl views it as, but you didn't fucking save my doll, she drowned.
Yeah.
It's something that was also, it's like, you didn't save Darcy or whatever the doll's name was, and she's kind of pissed at him about that. It's like, in this one act, he kind of was shown both sides, and that plants the seed of, like, well, can you be truly heroic if you do something that is considered bad or wrong? It's...
It seems like to him, everything is dichotomous. Like, there's yes. a duality with everything.
Yes,
and
yeah.
so, if you're going to be a hero, you're going to have to test out whether you're evil. If you're a family man, you're going to have to test out whether you can live alone, kind of stuff.
Yes, yeah.
So this guy simply just has a philosophy that he's acting upon.
Yeah.
And he happens to be doing it scientifically.
Which is super fascinating, I think.
Yeah, like, it is.
It's such an interesting way to approach, I mean, I was going to say serial killer, but he's not.
He's approaching that by the end.
By the end, he's getting there, but
kills
with
two people, in the same way. So.
Yeah, but a damaged individual, mm-hmm. it will say, enacting a horrible crime. The way he approaches it is unlike anything like I can remember seeing in a film, and that's what really drew me in.
Yeah, it's nice to see a criminal is treated not as a criminal so much as just
a man, I guess.
Yeah, like a test subject or something like that. Like he seems to be a vessel for exploring.
I think you're right, like you were saying, like the dichotomy. It's exploring the nature of duality, I guess.
Okay.
Oh, that's a lofty claim to throw out. But
no, I know, but.
Yeah.
But that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
That is his motivation.
Mm.
There's black and white. Yeah. There is two sides to everything. You know, that's what he's exploring. He's seeking to understand himself by exploring the extreme portion, like the polar opposite sides of his personality.
Yeah, like I said, the pendulum swings. Exactly. Like, either end it goes.
Exactly.
It's just a shame, like... I mean, granted, like I said earlier, he is, I feel, our protagonist. It's just a shame. I don't think we got nearly enough out of Rex, the boyfriend/husband/friend, who is seeking for the missing Saskia. I don't think there is nearly enough development or justification or anything really happening with that character to make me necessarily engage with him.
Yeah, I agree.
Which was a little bit disappointing, I guess.
Well, especially
given the first 15 minutes of the film, where it is all him and Saskia. Like, I was like, I'm willing to jump in and feel for this guy, but it's just, I think, because we jump in time and then we spend so much time with Raymond, we never really get a chance to rekindle or kind of connect again with Rex.
Yeah. But it seems like his character is almost a victim of the choppy nature of the narrative structure.
Yeah.
Because jumping 3 years into the future, where he's all of a sudden looking for his ex-wife again, I felt like I was just rolling with that as opposed to being invested with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Only because I just didn't... There's not really the setup.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
But... You know, like, say, like, again, going back to Memento, where the film plays forward in chunks, but obviously
it's working its way
backwards, and you start to get a feel for the plot, but also the character motivations and stuff. And
yeah.
You start to feel for the characters the closer you get to the beginning of the story,
mm.
which also happens to be the end of the film.
Yeah.
But in that film... There's still the setup, even though it's reversing time, and I mean that's only means that it was really well written
and structurally put together phenomenally.
It's like that film knew it was playing backwards, and so you need to make sure that you have stuff it's very fucking confusing to talk about. But there's stuff that needs to be played out.
You need to have the emotional beats almost played in reverse, so you can get to know the characters at the end of the story. Yeah,
precisely. So if you're going to be making a film, a thriller that's choppy and moving around a lot, you got to make sure that there's, even though you're jumping around, still they're set up so that you can allow the character, the audience to jump into behind the characters and you know, follow their stories.
Do you think it was maybe the filmmaker not necessarily caring as much about Rex's story, because it's not, like, I mean, clearly that's not the story the film's trying to say, like, based on, like, how much we've delved into Raymond and, like, the psyche and, like, the issues that that brings up. Do you think that Rex's story has necessarily, I hate to use the term depth to it, because, I mean, clearly there's something to his story.
I think there is, and I think that the turning point for him at the end, when he decides to drink the coffee and actually find out, is, it kind of mirrors the Raymond's choice to jump when he was a kid.
Okay,
So if that was the moment for Raymond that set the ball rolling, that led to his, you know, decisions to become a hero versus kidnapper thing, it seems like Rex is supposed to mirror that character. At the beginnings of Raymond's journey as a teenager seems to be the beginnings of Rex's journey as an adult.
Because he originally decides
he's not going to drink. He's just fucking forget about it. Let's just move on with our lives.
Yeah, clearly she's dead. You're a fucking psycho.
But then he has that same kind of, and same thought pattern, which is,
well, it's because as well, like, he remembers her burying the thing under the tree, and it's because Raymond very deliberately brought him back to the spot where he abducted Saskia from, and he kind of is overcome with emotions, and it's that thing of,
he says that you know, if it's predetermined that I shouldn't drink the coffee, then I'm gonna drink the coffee, and he storms back and drinks it.
Yeah,
and that's precisely why,
which is Raymond, why Raymond jumped off the balcony. Yeah.
So there's, so Rex has a very large role to play in the film, but at the same time, there's not a gravity to his character because he's not the serial killer.
Even that thing, like you just said, like the whole idea of the reason he drinks the coffee is based somewhat on the explanation that Raymond has given of, like, you're not supposed to jump, so I jumped.
Mm.
And Rex is like, by all accounts, I should not drink the coffee, so I'm going to fucking drink the coffee. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And that's a decision that is fueled by Raymond's motivations.
True.
Versus his own.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know, it's a strange one.
It really is. The more we're talking about it, the more I really enjoy it. Like, there's a lot going on there that is not, like, on the base view, you're like, yeah, that was fine. But if it's one that's during discussion, you're like, that, I don't know, a lot going on.
It's not bad. I mean, I enjoyed, there's some, if we talk about, like, the technicalities of filmmaking itself.
Well, I kind of want to get into that in a minute, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Kind of break that down and,
because we talked about the narrative structure a little bit.
And the themes and the characters and everything, yeah.
There wasn't too much creative flair with the shots, I felt.
No, I think within the first 5 minutes you said that this looks like it was a shot like a daytime soap opera, a made-for-TV movie.
Yeah, it was just simple pans a lot, and then, you know, it's just like,
yeah.
But at the same time,
I mean, it's competently
pans. The thing is, the daytime, when we say the daytime shots, daytime TV shots, you're expecting cheap shots, so it's pans, and it's just like
simple zooms, and
yeah, some zooms. But then those kinds of shots do work in a thriller, because they're often point of view and point of view shots.
Exactly.
And then that works for say, like, somebody that's spying on them, for example.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, now that I think about it, it's not actually that bad.
No, and I mean,
it's got a point to it.
I mean, the point of, like, even, like, he's very competently using cinematic language as a storytelling tool. Like you even brought up the scene where he saves the little girl from drowning. Like, it's a deliberate choice to cut in close to his face at the end, like, to establish that it's, you know, he's thinking of these loftier ideas, and it's competently made, but there's nothing that stands out, I guess, in terms of the technicalities of the film. I think what makes the film stand out is the narrative and the way that that's structured.
Mm. It's hard to... Yeah, I'm not sure, because it's one of those... It actually reminds me of Insomnia.
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same
because
thing.
Because it's kind of the same thing, right? Like, it's a really good film, just as Insomnia was. But it just needs to be polished and tightened a little bit.
Yeah.
And therefore, you want to do a remake. Fortunately for Insomnia, we got Christopher Nolan's remake.
And Al Pacino fucking, and Robin Williams, like, you know, yeah. Three Academy Award winners.
Which is outstanding and so much better than the original.
Yeah.
All credit to the original, though, because, yes, you know, yes. Conceptually, it's come up with a lot of things.
Come on.
Yeah, exactly. But then this one, does anyone remember the remake of this?
With Jeff Bridges and Kiefer Sutherland and Sandy Bullock.
Because I don't see it in any best of lists.
No, oh god, no.
I didn't even know of this fucking remake.
Yeah.
And I tend to stay away from Sandra Bullock.
At all costs.
Even though Jeff Bridges is in it, maybe I could make an exception.
But, I mean, I like I said, I saw it merely 20 years ago. I remember little to nothing of the film. As far as I remember, it's just a fine, middling... Like, I don't even remember if it has the muddled narrative, like, oh, not muddled narrative, the non-linear narrative structure to it. Like
the strongest point of this film.
Yeah, like, I feel if I could be really speaking out of turn, having not seen it for 20 years, like, but I feel if it did, I would remember that. And the fact that I don't makes me inclined to think that they've just done it as a straightforward kind of thriller, I guess.
They've Hollywoodized it.
They've taken the idea of a guy taking a girl from a gas station and then kind of watching and tormenting the partner of that person and then getting in contact with him.
Sorry, was the question whether the remake goes into the psychology of the...
Not necessarily the psychology, it was more about the structure of that one, whether it's non-linear like this.
No, it was completely linear. Yeah. It was a thriller.
Yeah, it was just done as a base. Yeah. And I'm guessing
it was a Sandra Bullock film.
Yeah, and I'm guessing after when Kiefer Sutherland when Jeff Bridges reveals himself to Kiefer Sutherland, is like, "Hey, I'm the guy that did it." Then we get the motivations and the psyche. I'm assuming.
I could be wrong.
Yeah,
but I feel like it's.
We're talking about a thriller that's like 20 years ago. We both watched.
Yeah, I could be wrong. Somebody out there would know that.
Does it be like define the net?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I have a feeling from memory that you didn't know anything. You like didn't get to see Jeff Bridges until Sutherland saw Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, that was it. It was non-linear, like Jeff Bridges was kind mysterious. Of present, and he was like off in the background, kind of as the guy lurking.
Yeah, it was more from the husband's point of view, and you didn't get to see the side by side stories being told or anything. I think.
Yeah, but because it was 1991, Jeff Bridges is top billed, and Kiefer is coming off of Lost Boys, so, but it's...
Well, it sounds like there needs to be another remake.
No, there doesn't.
Well, I'm telling you now that the film is... I really enjoyed this movie, but I still think that it needed to be polished because Rex's character was lackluster, but he's crucial to the story, so you want to have... Maybe the actor just couldn't really... didn't have the chops to...
Well, that was the next thing I kind of wanted to get on, was performances. Mm. I mean, the performance of Raymond was fine.
It was quite good.
He was pretty good. Everyone else was fine.
It was a good choice to have an evil goatee.
Yeah.
It suits serial killers and evil
looking
people.
Like a weird, bizarre love child of... What did we say? It was Robert De Niro, Sean Penn, with a little bit of...
Stella Skateboard.
Stella Skateboard. With a little bit of Gerard Depardieu in the right light. But it's... I don't know. But it's... There was no performance that made me be like, yeah, like that's...
I really enjoyed Saskia's performance. She was bubbly. She... seemed really natural, especially towards the end when she
actually had the
exchange with Raymond's character.
Yeah, no, I forgot about her because she's not in it that much.
she's very natural.
Yeah,
and I actually gave a shit about you know, her situation.
Especially at the end when she's wanting to get the key ring for Rex, and that's what leads to the abduction. Like,
she was just really warm and bubbly, and she did a great job. I think everybody else was a little bit meh.
They were serviceable. They were fine. They weren't bad. They weren't outstanding. It was fine. Yeah, which
that's why I'd be pushing for the remake, but not Hollywoodized.
No, you need this. You need the same structure that this one is based out in to make it work. And that's what made this work, I think.
Is it stupid to ask for remakes all the time?
No.
Yes.
I think it depends. I think given your arguments, like, or the evidence you've put forth of why you would want this to be remade, I think that's just. But if you were just to be like, man, it's been a while since we've had a Jurassic Park movie.
Yeah.
Like, that's...
No, I don't want to be like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, because it's like, if you asked for a remake after seeing the original Insomnia.
Yeah.
And then everyone goes like, oh, we don't need a fucking remake, it's fine. But then you get something that's even better.
Yes, yes.
That even better expresses the ideas.
Yeah.
That the original's trying to put forward.
But yeah, then, do you think that's just a matter of time and place and money for this film then? Like in 1988, Dutch production with, you know, not the biggest budget behind it. So, like...
Yeah, that's going to have to play a role, right?
Yeah.
That's going to have to play a major role.
But... It's fine. I'm now stepping back. No, like I really enjoyed this film.
So, me too. I did. There are really nice shots in it. Like you mentioned again when Rex is drinking the coffee
and he's storming around the park, and there's the lightning strikes in the background. It's really good. The
point of view shot from Raymond, just looking at him as he's parading around the raining park, and you know everything is kind of lost through the rain padded window panel, and then there's a shot of his face with the window wipers, and it clears up as the wiper goes down, and then the shot just lingers as the raindrops kind of deteriorate his face, and it's just like it doesn't really necessarily have to mean anything, but it just
adds to the added experience. Thing of after Rex drinks the coffee, there's never a window wipe again. It doesn't clear, and it gets even more and more rainy to the point of like, there should be a window wipe here, but it never comes.
Mm.
Which, like, I'm just like, that's well done, clever. I like what you're saying there. That's good. Like, but and also the added thing of like Rex after he drinks the coffee is like, fuck you, and throws the cup at the windshield. I just was like, that's a fun little character thing. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's really good. And you know, I really love the ending.
Yeah,
I would have liked to have it finish on. Say just fade to black when his lighter goes out in his in the little box that's been buried under some roses.
I kind of like the shot of his wife watering the two rose bushes he's planted. I kind of did that, that is
rather interesting.
And just cutting to him kind of looking on, and it's that thing of like, because it lets you as an audience question like, does he have empathy? Like, is there something there that he actually gives a shit that he killed two people? Or is it just a thing of like, oh yeah, that's where they are?
Well, it's rather heady because you're watching the wife who he should care for water the plants that are directly above people that have been left to die in boxes.
Yeah.
There's so much to kind of pull apart there.
Yeah, dissect there.
You know... It's so. It doesn't tell you much because you don't know whether. You don't know his. You don't really know his relationship with his family too much.
Yeah.
They have, you know, some nice lunches and he buys them red wine sometimes. He seems
to genuinely care about and love his daughters.
But it seems. But it could be just a massive facade, you know?
Like Dexter, that scene with his wife that is really brutal and he's very analytical in the way that he approaches talking to her, so it's. It's an interesting character. Like, I would have been happy to spend a little bit more time with him, I guess, but...
But again, it's a very long movie.
Yeah. Not really, though. It's under 2 hours. like
for a thriller, it's quite well. I don't know. We're talking about Zodiac.
I'm basing this on, like, say, for example, the ruling class, which was nearly three, and they gave us fucking nothing.
And we were talking about Zodiac last week, and that's three hours. So true.
I don't know.
On the whole, the film doesn't feel like 2 hours. There's portions that drag, but on the whole, it's the pacing's pretty good. Like it flows, and you're getting drawn into it. It's not bad. It's a pretty good movie.
I enjoy it. Do you want to hear a little bit of trivia about it?
Yeah.
Well, this one's kind of a little bit more history than trivia. So basically, the story behind it, Tim Crabb, who wrote the book that this is then based off of, he got inspired by reading a newspaper article where it was a woman went missing from a gas station, and he found that notion really intriguing and kind of wrote this story based around that. And then after he'd kind of written the manuscript, got in touch with these people, and turned out, like, oh yeah, no, she just hopped on, she was a tourist and just hopped on the wrong bus. She was found the next day. And so he's like, oh cool, it's glad that what I wrote didn't end up happening to these people. But
that's a much boring story though.
Yeah, yeah. And basically when he was writing the manuscript, the director, George, he immediately started reading the manuscript and was like, immediately I want to buy the film rights to this. And basically, after the book was published, and that was called The Golden Egg, which is the reference to Saskia's dream, but yeah. But what ended up happening when they were adapting it, they did two drafts working together. It was George Sluzier and Tim Crabb writing together. And it was George's idea to kind of muddle the narrative and make it non-linear and kind of play with the structure that was really different to what happened in the book. And so they kind of had a bit of a falling out, and the writer left at that point and is apparently like, man, you're fucking up my thriller.
Well, yeah, but if he wrote the book, then the director is allowed to rape the story.
That was his thing. He was like, well, I bought the rights,
yeah,
so I can do what I want with it.
I always, you know, like, I always fall back on, if you watch the Jodorowsky's Dune,
yeah,
and Jodorowsky's like, I raped Dune.
Yeah.
I raped the book Dune, and I made it mine, I raped it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, right on, you just should do that.
You're doing what you're doing.
Do your vision.
Yeah, there are so many versions, like, I mean, shit, Jaws is, like,
yeah,
so much better than the book. Jurassic Park is so different to the book. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's... it works.
It's fine. It's totally fine. Rape the books.
So we'll move on to some actual trivia itself. Bernard-Pierre Donadieu, who played Raymond, had some unorthodox methods to interact with his colleagues. He deliberately picked a fight with Genet Beauvau, who played Rex, prior to their fight scene, the scene where Rex, like, he reveals himself and Rex beats the shit out of him at the car park. He basically picked a fight with him so Beauvau's rage would look genuine. And in the scene where he drugs Joanna... And in the scene where he drugs the woman who plays Saskia, he held her so tight that she could not actually breathe and she started to have a panic attack.
Yeah, you can feel that, though, because that is the most intense sequence in the whole film. And her eyes look genuinely fucking frightened.
Yeah, yeah. So this guy was method, apparently.
That's good.
The film was submitted to the Academy Awards in 1988 as the official Dutch entry for Best Foreign Language. However, the AMPAS disqualified it because they determined that there was too much French dialogue in the film to warrant it being a Dutch film. I thought that was kind of interesting that they're very stringent on those kind of... It's a Dutch production, but it's French language, yeah. So it's not...
So the quality, the metric for that is not where it's from, and not who made it, but the quantity of language in it?
I guess because it's foreign language film, so
yeah.
They would then, because it's primarily French language, assume it is... Yeah, it's a weird one, right?
Yeah.
But I thought that was an interesting...
Well, they you know... They seem to know what they're doing.
The production ran short on... Yeah, they clearly don't.
They, well...
Never do. So the production ran short of money, mainly for feeding the cast and the crew of the film. And according to George Sluzier, he actually went to some local French underworld figures who lent him money to finish the film. But only after threatening him that he had to pay them back, or else, you know, we'll break your legs.
Jesus Christ, dude.
Yeah. The other thing I was doing, did a little bit of research on this film today, and one of the things I thought was really interesting, I found out, was when the film was released, Stanley Kubrick considered this to be one of the scariest films he'd ever seen. And after he saw it, got in contact with George Sluzier, and apparently the two of them got together and hung out, because Kubrick was really interested in the editing of the film and, like, how to present the narrative in the way that he did.
That's rad.
I thought that was kind of cool.
He's got a Kubrick's tick of approval.
Yeah, well, that's it. And that's especially so since Kubrick's idea of filmmaking was, the films I'm going to make are going to be the best of that. Like, The Shining is going to be the best horror film. Full Metal Jacket is going to be the best Psyche of War film. Like, and Paths of Glory and stuff as well. Like, yeah. Yeah.
That's sick.
To be like, oh no, yeah, you beat The Shining and this is the scariest film. I thought that was kind of cool. Even though it's not a horror. But I guess the notions are...
Thrillers and horrors are quite different.
Yeah, but the notion is very scary.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I don't want to be kidnapped.
I don't want to be put in a box. Buried alive, that would suck.
Fuck that.
So I guess we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. So the film is available still through Criterion as a one-disc DVD or a one-disc Blu-ray. It's also available through them on iTunes and Hulu Plus. But if you get the physical copies, it comes with the following special features of a new interview with director George Sluzier, and new interview with actor Johanna Desterge, who played Saskia, as well as the trailer and usual book and essays that Criterion always do.
It's all right.
Yeah, so a couple of, you know, little features, nothing exorbitant, but good.
It's fine. It's what you would expect from a foreign film from the late 80s.
Yeah. But, yeah, I guess that unless you got anything else, that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at The Vanishing.
Well, I mentioned Jodorowsky's Dune. I just want to say that's really good. It's a documentary about Jodorowsky trying to make his version of Dune, the sci-fi novel.
Yeah.
If anyone hasn't seen that, go see it, because it's really great.
And also, if you haven't seen El Topo or The Holy Mountain by Jodorowsky himself, watch those movies. They are fucking trips.
Oh, and then you can read Chris's review on the website, because you reviewed Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah, ages ago I checked up a review of that, yeah. I like that movie a lot.
Me too.
But yeah, I guess that'll probably wrap us up looking at The Vanishing. We will be back next week. I want to look at your face when I reveal what next week's... in a fortnight's time, I should say. What the next film is going to be. It is from Denmark. From 1922. You're looking a little sad. It is called Haxan. And it is a pseudo-documentary dissecting witchcraft of the Middle Ages.
That kind of sounds good.
I am so fucking intrigued by this movie. Yeah, right? Like, a 1922 black and white silent documentary about witchcraft. This shit's gonna be gnarly. I am in for this.
I'm certain that I will have never seen anything like it.
Yeah. I'm really excited for this one.
Rad.
Hopefully it lives up to what I hope it will be, which is dry and fucked up. But, as always, if you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, please feel free to send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @CriterionQuest. But other than that, we'll be back in a fortnight's time with the next film. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.